leaving Richard to approach the throne and speak quietly to the king. My arm is around her waist as she leans against me. Together we look, unseeing, over the beautiful sunny gardens inside the thick castle walls, laid out below us like a piece of embroidery in a frame. I have to command everything now, she says quietly. Edmund is dead, and the king is lost to himself. I am so alone, Jaquetta. I'm like a widow with no friends. The council? I ask. I'm guessing that they would put York back in as Lord Protector, if they knew how frail the king truly is. I appoint the council, she says. They do as I say. But they will talk. What they say in London doesn't matter to us here at Kenilworth. But when you have to call a parliament. I will summon them to Coventry, where they love me and honour the king. We won't go back to London, and I will only summon the men who honour me, no one who follows York. I look at her, quite appalled. You will have to go to London, Your Grace. Summer is all very well, but you can't move the court and the parliament from the city forever. And you can't exclude the men of York from government. She shakes her head. I hate the people there, and they hate me. London is diseased and rebellious. They take the side of Parliament and York against me. They call me a foreign queen. I shall rule them from a distance. I am Queen of London, but they shall never see me, nor have a penny of my money, nor a glimpse of my patronage, nor a word of my blessing. Kent, Essex, Sussex, Hampshire, London. They're all my enemies. They are all traitors. And I will never forgive them. But the king... He will get better, she says determinedly. This is a bad day for him. Today is a bad day, just a day. Some days he's quite well, and I will find a way of curing him. I have doctors working on new cures all the time. I have licensed alchemists to distill waters for him. The king doesn't like alchemy, or anything like that. We have to find a cure. I am issuing licenses to alchemists to pursue their studies. I have to consult them. It is allowed now. And what do they say? I ask her. The alchemists. They say that he has to be weak, as the kingdom is weak, but that they will see him reborn. He will be as new again, and the kingdom will be as new again. They say he will go through fire and be made as pure as a white rose. A white rose? I'm shocked. She shakes her head. They don't mean York. They mean as pure as a white moon. As pure as white water, driven snow. It doesn't matter. I bow my head, but I think it probably does matter. I glance back at Richard. He's kneeling beside the throne, and his king is leaning forwards to speak earnestly to him. Richard is nodding. Gentle as when he's talking to one of our little boys. I see the king, his head shaking, stammering over a sentence. And I see my husband take his hand and say the words slowly, carefully, as a kind man will speak slowly to an idiot. Oh, my Margaret, I am so sorry for you, I blurt out. Her grey blue eyes are filled with tears. I'm all alone now, she says. I've never been so alone in all my life before. But I will not be turned on the wheel of fortune. I will not fall down. I will rule this country and make the king well and see my son inherit. Richard thought that she could not rule the country from the Midlands. But summer comes and goes. The swallows swirl every evening around the roofs of Kenilworth, and every evening there are fewer and fewer as they are flying south, slipping away from us, and still the Queen refuses to go back to London. She rules by command. There is no pretense of discussion. She simply orders a royal council who are picked to do her bidding and never argue with her. She does not call a parliament of the commons, who would have demanded to see the king in his capital city. Londoners are quick to complain that the foreigners who steal their trade and overcharge decent Englishmen are the result of a foreign queen who hates London and will not defend honest merchants. Then a French fleet raids the coast and goes farther than any has dared to go before. They enter right into the port of Sandwich and loot the town, tearing the place apart, taking away everything of value and firing the marketplace. Everyone blames the Queen. "Are they really saying that I ordered them to come?" she exclaims to Richard. "Are they mad? Why would I order the French to attack Sandwich?"
"The attack was led by a friend of yours, Pierre de Brézé," my husband points out dryly. "And he had maps of the shoals and the riverbed, English maps. People ask, how did he get them, if not from you? They're saying that you helped him because you may need him to help you, and you swore that you would see Kent punished for their support of Warwick. You know, de Brézé played a merry jest on us. He brought balls and rackets and played a game of tennis in the town square. It was an insult. The people of Sandwich think that you set him on to insult them, that this is French humour. We don't find it funny." She narrows her eyes at him.
"I hope you're not turning Yorkist," she says quietly. "I should be sorry to think that you turned against me, and it would break Jaquetta's heart. I should be sorry to see you executed. You have avoided death 100 times, Richard Woodville. I should be sorry to be the one who ordered it."
Richard faces her, without flinching. "You asked me why people blame you. I'm telling you, Your Grace, it doesn't mean that I think such things, except I am puzzled by de Brézé holding the charts. I'm only making a fair report. And I will tell you more. If you don't control the pirates and the French ships in the narrow seas, then the Earl of Warwick will sail out of Calais and do it for you, and everyone will hail him as a hero. You don't damage his reputation by letting pirates rule the narrow seas, by letting de Brézé raid Sandwich. You damage your own. The southern towns have to be protected. The king has to be seen to respond to this challenge. You have to make the narrow seas safe for English ships, even if you don't like Kent. It is the beachhead of your kingdom, and you have to defend it." She nods, her anger dissipated at once. "Yes, I see. I do see, Richard. I just hadn't thought of the south coast. Would you draw up a plan for me? How we should protect the south coast?" He bows, steady as always.
"It would be my honour, Your Grace."
Rochester Castle, Kent, November 1457. "Well, I, for one, don't think much of your plan," I say to him sarcastically. We're in an old, damp castle on the wide, wet estuary of the Medway in November, one of the greyest, coldest, darkest months of the English year. The castle was built by the Normans for defence, not for comfort, and it is so cold and so miserable here that I've commanded the children to stay at home at Grafton rather than join us. Richard's piecemeal map of the southern coast of England is spread before us on his work table, the towns that he knows are vulnerable ringed in red, as he considers how to fortify and defend them with no armaments and no men. "I would have hoped that your plan would have had you posted to garrison the tower, and we would have been in London for Christmas," I say. "For sure that would have suited me better." He smiles. He's too absorbed to reply properly.
"I know. I'm sorry for it, beloved."
I look a little closer at his work. He doesn't even have a complete map of the coastline. No one has ever drawn such a thing. This is pieced together from his own knowledge and from the reports of sailors and pilots. Even fishermen have sent him little sketches of their own bay, their own dock, the reefs and shoals outside their harbour. "Is the Queen sending you enough weapons?" He shakes his head. "She has a huge grant from Parliament to raise archers and buy cannon to use against the French. But there's nothing issued to me. And how can I fortify the towns with no men to serve, and no cannon to fire?"
"How can you?" I ask.
"I shall have to train the townsmen," he says. "And these are all towns on the coast, so at least I have ships, captains, and sailors, if I can persuade them to enlist. I shall have to get them trained up into some kind of defence."
"So what is she doing with the money?" I ask.
Now I have his full attention. He looks up at me, his face grave. "She's not protecting us against France. She is arming her men in London," he says. "I think she plans to charge the Earl of Warwick, the Earl of Salisbury, and the Duke of York with treason, and bring them to London to stand trial." I gasp.
"They will never come."
"She's certainly preparing for them to come. If they come at all, they will bring their own forces and their own retinue, and she will need her 1,300 archers," my husband says grimly. "I think she's preparing for war with them."
Westminster Palace, London, winter to spring, 1458.
We are summoned, along with the rest of the lords, in the cold days after Christmas, to a London more dark and suspicious than ever before, to find that far from accusation and punishment, the King has overruled the Queen and plans a reconciliation. He has risen up, fired by a vision. He is suddenly well again and strong and burning with an idea to resolve the conflict between the two great houses by demanding that the York lords shall pay for their cruelties at St. Albans by being fined, building a chantry for the honoured dead, and then swearing to end the blood feud with the heirs of their enemies. The Queen is calling for the Earl of Warwick to be impeached for treason, but the King wants him forgiven as a repentant sinner. The whole of London is like a keg of dynamite with a dozen boys striking sparks around it, and the King quietly says the Pater Noster, uplifted by his new idea. The vengeful heirs of Somerset and Northumberland go everywhere with their swords at the ready, and the promise of a feud that will last for 10 generations. The York lords are impenitent, the Earl of Warwick's men richly turned out in their liveries, Warwick a byword for generosity and gifts to Londoners, boasting that already they hold Calais and the narrow seas, and who dare gainsay them. And the Lord Mayor has armed every good man in London and commanded him to patrol to keep the peace, which just introduces another army for everyone to fear. The Queen summons me in the twilight of a winter afternoon. "I want you to come out with me," she says. "There's a man I want you to meet." Together we don our capes, pull up our hoods to shield our faces. "Who is it?" "I want you to come with me to an alchemist." I freeze, like a deer scenting danger. "Your Grace, Eleanor Cobham consulted alchemists, and Eleanor Cobham was imprisoned for 11 years and died in Peel Castle." She looks at me blankly. "And so?" "One of the fixed plans of my life is not to end up as Eleanor Cobham." I wait. For a moment her heart lifts. Her face smiles. She dissolves into laughter. "Ah, Jaquetta, are you telling me that you're not some mad, ugly, bad old witch?" "Your Grace, every woman is a mad, ugly, bad old witch somewhere in her heart. The task of my life is to conceal this. The task of every woman is to deny this."
"What do you mean?"
The world does not allow women like Eleanor, women like me, to thrive. The world cannot tolerate women who think and feel, women like me. When we weaken, or when we get old, the world falls on us with the weight of a waterfall. We cannot bring our gifts to the world. The world we live in will not tolerate things that cannot be understood, things that cannot be easily explained. In this world, a wise woman hides her gifts. Eleanor Cobham was an inquiring woman. She met with others who sought the truth. She educated herself, and she sought masters with whom to study. She paid a terrible price for this. She was an ambitious woman. She paid the price for this, too. I wait to see if she's understood, but her round, pretty face is puzzled. Your Grace, you will put me in danger if you ask me to use my gifts. She faces me. She knows what she's doing. Jacquetta, I have to ask you to do this, even if it is dangerous for you. It is a great demand, Your Grace. Your husband, the Duke of Bedford, asked for nothing less. He married you so that you would serve England in this way. I had to obey him. He was my husband, and he could protect me. He was right to ask you to use your gifts to save England. And now I ask it too, and I will protect you. I shake my head. I have a very real sense that there will come a time when she will not be there, and I will face a court like Joan of Arc, like Eleanor Cobham, a court of men, and there will be documents written against me, and evidence produced against me, and witnesses who will swear against me, and no one will protect me. Why now? Because I think the king is under a spell, and has been for years. The Duke of York, or Duchess Cecily, or the French king, or somebody, how should I know who? But someone has put him under a spell that makes him like a sleeping baby, or makes him like a trusting child. I have to make sure that he never slips away from us again. Only alchemy or magic can protect him. He's awake now. He's like a wakeful child now. He has a dream of harmony and peace, and then he will fall asleep again, smiling at his lovely dream. I pause. I know she's right. The king has slipped through to another world, and we need him in this one. I will come with you. But if I think your alchemist is a charlatan, I will have no truck with him. That's the very reason I want you to come, she says, to see what you think of him. But come now. We go on foot through the darkened streets of Westminster, hand in hand. We have no ladies in waiting, not even a guard. For one moment only, I close my eyes in horror at what Richard, my husband, would say if he knew that I was taking such a risk, and with the Queen herself. But she knows where she's going, sure-footed on the muck of the streets, imperious to the crossing sweepers, with a little lad going ahead of us with a flaming torch. She guides us down the narrow lanes and turns into an alley. At the end of it is a great door set in the wall. I take the iron ring set beside it and pull. A great carillon answers us, and the sound of dogs barking somewhere at the back. The porter opens the grill. "Who calls?" he asks. Margaret steps up. "Tell your master that she of Anjou has come," she says. At once the door swings open. She beckons to me, and we go inside. We step into a forest, not a garden. It is like a plantation of fir trees inside the tall walls, in the very heart of London, a secret woodland, like a London garden under an enchantment to grow wild. I glance at Margaret, and she smiles at me, as if she knows how this place will strike me, as a hidden world within the real one. Perhaps it is even the doorway to another world inside this. We walk down a twisting path that takes us through the green shadow of towering trees and then to a small house, overburdened with dark trees around it, sweet-scented boughs leaning on every roof, chimneys poking through foliage, and singeing the needles of the pine trees. I sniff the air. There's the smell of a forge, thin smoke from hot coals, and the familiar, never-forgotten scent of sulphur. "He lives here," I say. She nods. "You will see him. You can judge for yourself." We wait beside a stone bench before the house, and then a little door swings open, and the alchemist comes out, a dark cloak around him, wiping his hands on his sleeves. He bows to the queen and directs a piercing look at me. "You are of the House of Melusina?" he asks. "I am Lady Rivers now," I say. "I have long wanted to meet you. I knew Master Fort, who worked for your husband, the Duke. He told me that you had the gift of scrying." "I never saw anything that made much sense to me," I say. He nods. "Will you scry for me?" I hesitate. "What if I see something that is against the law?" He looks at the queen. "I say it is allowed," she rules. "Anything." His smile is gentle.
"Only you and I will see the looking glass, and I will keep it secret. It shall be as a confessional. I am an ordained priest. I am Father Jeffreys. No one will know what you see, but you and I. I will tell Her Grace only the interpretation."
"Is it to find the spell that will heal the king? Is it to do good for him?"
"That is my intention. I am already preparing some waters for him. I think that your presence at the moment of distilling will make the difference. He is well now, he can stay awake now. But I think he has some deep wound inside. He has never grown away from his mother. He has never truly become a man. He needs to transform. He needs that change from a child to a man. It is an alchemy of the person." He looks at me. "You have lived at his court. You have known him for many years. Do you think this?" I nod.
"He is of the moon," I tell him unwillingly. "And cold and damp. My Lord Bedford used to say he needed fire." I nod towards Margaret. "He thought Her Grace would bring fire and power to him." The Queen's face works as if she's about to cry. "No," she says sadly. "He has all but put me out. He is too much for me. I am chilled, and I have all but lost my spirit. I have no one who can make me warm any more."
"If the king is cold and wet, the kingdom will sink beneath floods of tears," the alchemist says.
"Please do it, Chaketa," the queen whispers. "We will all three swear never to tell anyone about this."
I sigh. "I will." Father Jeffreys bows to the queen. "Will you wait here, Your Grace?"
She glances to the half-open door of his house. I know she's longing to see inside, but she submits to his rules. "Very well." She wraps her cloak around herself and sits on the stone bench. He gestures to me to go inside, and I step over the threshold. In the room on the right, there is a great fireplace in the centre, with a fire of charcoal warming a big-bellied cauldron. In the cauldron, in warm water, is a great vessel with a silver tube that passes through a cold bath. At the end of the tube is the steady drip of an elixir made from the steam. The heat in the room is stifling, and he guides me to the room on the left, where there's a table and a great book, and beyond it, the scrying mirror. It is all so familiar, from the sweet smell of the elixir to the scent of the forge outside, that I pause for a moment, and I am back in the Hôtel de Bourbon at Paris, a maid and yet a bride.
the new wife of the Duke of Bedford.
"Do you see something?"
he asks eagerly. "Only the past." He puts a chair before me and takes the curtain from the mirror. I see myself reflected back, so much older than the girl who was commanded to look in the mirror at Paris.
"I have some salts for you to sniff," he says. "I think it will help you to see."
He takes a little purse from the drawer in the table and opens the drawstring.
"Here," he says.
I take the purse in my hand. Inside is some white powder. I hold it to my face and cautiously breathe in. There is a moment when my head seems to swim, and then I look up, and there is the scrying mirror, but I cannot see my own reflection. My image has disappeared, and in my place there is a swirl of snow, and white flakes falling like the petals of white roses. It is the battle I saw once before, the men fighting uphill, a swaying bridge that falls, throwing them into the water, the snow on the ground turning red with blood, and always the swirling petals of the white snow. I see the iron grey of wide, wide skies. It is the north of England, bitterly cold, and out of the snow comes a young man like a lion. Look again. I can hear his voice, but I cannot see him. What is to become of the king? What would heal his wound? I see a small room, a dark room, a hidden room. It is hot and stuffy, and there's a sense of terrible menace in the warm, silent darkness. There's only one arrow slit of a window in the thick stone walls. The only light comes from the window. The only brightness in the darkness of the room is that single thread of light. I look towards it, drawn by the only sign of life in the black. Then it is blocked, as if by a man standing before it, and there is nothing but darkness. I hear the alchemist sigh behind me, as if I've whispered my vision to him, and he has seen it all.
"God bless," he says quietly. "God bless him and keep him."
Then he speaks a little more clearly.
"Anything else?"
I see the charm that I threw into the deep water of the Thames tied to the ribbons, a different ribbon for each season. The charm shaped like a crown that washed away and told me that the king would never come back to us. I see it deep in the water, dangling on a thread. Then I see it being pulled to the surface, up and up, and then it breaks from the water like a little fish popping on the surface of a summer stream, and it is my daughter, Elizabeth, who smilingly pulls it from the water and laughs with joy and puts it on her finger like a ring.
"Elizabeth," I say wonderingly, "my girl."
He steps forward and gives me a glass of small ale.
"Who is Elizabeth?" he asks.
"My daughter. I don't know why I was thinking of her."
"She has a ring shaped like a crown?"
"In my vision, she had the ring that signified the king. She put it on her own finger."
He smiles gently. "These are mysteries."
"There is no mystery about the vision. She had the ring that was the crown of England, and she smiled and put it on her finger."
He drops the curtain across the mirror.
"Do you know what this means?"
he asks.
"My daughter is to be close to the crown," I say.
I'm puzzling through the scrying.
How could such a thing be? She's married to Sir John Grey. They have a son and another baby on the way. How can she put the crown of England on her finger?
"It is not clear to me," he says. "I will think on it, and perhaps I will ask you to come again."
"How could Elizabeth have a ring like a crown on her finger?"
"Sometimes our visions come darkly. We don't know what we see. This one is very unclear. It is a mystery. I will pray on it."
I nod.
When a man wants a mystery, it is generally better to leave him mystified. Nobody loves a clever woman. "Will you come here and pour this liquid into a mould?" he asks me. I follow him into the first room, and he takes a flask from the wall, shakes it gently, and then hands it to me. "Hold it." I cup the bowl in my hands, and at once I feel it grow warm under the heat of my fingers. "Now pour it," he says, and gestures to the moulds that are on his table. Carefully, I fill each one with the silvery liquid, and then pass the flask back to him. "Some processes call for the touch of a woman," he says quietly. "Some of the greatest alchemy has been done by a husband and wife, working together." He gestures to the bowl of warm water that is over the charcoal stove. "This method was invented by a woman and named for her." "I have no skills," I say, denying my own abilities. "And when I have visions, they are sent by God and are unclear to me." He takes my hand and tucks it under his arm as he leads the way to the door. "I understand. I will send for you only if I cannot manage to work for the Queen without you. And you are right to hide your light. This is a world that doesn't understand a skilled woman. It is a world that fears the craft. We all have to do our work in secret, even now, when the kingdom needs our guidance so much." "The king will not get better," I say suddenly, as if the truth is forced out of me. "No," he agrees, sadly. "We must do what we can." "And the vision I had of him, in the tower."
"Yes?"
"I saw him, and then someone stood before the window, and it was all dark."
"You think he will meet his death in the tower?"
"Not just him." I'm filled with a sudden urgency. I feel, I don't know why, it is as if one of my own children were in there. A boy of mine. Perhaps two of my boys. I see it, but I'm not there. I can't prevent it. I can't save the king, and I can't save them either. They will go into the tower and not come out. Gently, he takes my hand.
"We can make our own destiny," he says. "You can protect your children. We can, perhaps, help the king. Take your visions to church and pray. And I will hope for understanding, too. Will you tell the queen what you have seen?"
"No," I say. "She has enough sorrows for a young woman already. And besides, I know nothing for certain." "What did you see?" Margaret demands of me as we walk home, anonymous in our cloaks through the crowded dark streets. We link arms in case we are jostled, and Margaret's bright hair is covered by her hood. "He would tell me nothing." "I had three visions, none of them very helpful," I say.
"What were they?"
"One of a battle, uphill, in snow, and a bridge that gave way and threw the soldiers into the stream."
"You think it will come to a battle?" she demands.
"You think it won't?" I say dryly. She nods at my common sense appraisal.
"I want a battle," she declares. "I'm not afraid of it. I'm not afraid of anything." "And the other vision?"
"Of a small room in the tower, and the light going out." She hesitates for a moment. "There are many small rooms in the tower, and the light gets blocked for many young men." A cold finger is laid on the nape of my neck. I wonder if a child of mine will ever be housed in the tower, and one dawn see the light blocked as a big man moves across the arrow slit.
"That's all I saw," I say.
"And your last vision, you said there were three." "A ring, shaped like a crown, which signified the crown of England, and it was in deep water and was drawn out of the water. "By who?" she demands. "Was it me?" It is very rare that I lie to Margaret of Anjou. I love her, and besides, I'm sworn to follow her and her house. But I would not name my beautiful daughter to her as the girl who holds the ring of England in her hand. "A swan," I say at random, "a swan took the ring of the crown of England in its beak." "A swan?" she asks me breathlessly. "Are you sure?" She pauses in the middle of the street, and a carter shouts at us and we step aside. "Just so." "What can it mean? Do you see what it means?" I shake my head. I had only conjured the swan because I didn't want to mention my daughter's name in this vision. Now, as so often, I find that the lie needs another lie. "A swan is the badge of heir to the House of Lancaster," she reminds me. "Your vision means that my son, Edward, will take the throne." Visions are never certain. Her smile is radiant. "Don't you see? This is the solution for us. The king can step aside for his son," she says. "This is my way forward. The swan is my boy. I will put Prince Edward on the throne of England." Although he has launched one of the most controversial and dangerous meetings that Parliament has ever had to endure, although he has summoned three magnates who have brought their own armies, the king is joyously at peace with himself and with the world. He has every faith that these great matters will be best agreed in loving kindness without him. He plans to arrive after everything has been decided to give it all his blessing. He absents himself from London to pray for peace, while they argue and calculate the price of agreement, threaten each other, come near to blows, and finally forge a settlement. It drives Margaret beside herself to see her husband step back from his work of ruling his lords, to become the king who will intercede only with heaven for his country's safety, but leaves it to others to make it safe. "How can he summon them to London and just abandon us?" she demands of me. "How can he be such a fool to make half a peace?" It is indeed only half a peace. Everyone agrees that the York lords should pay for attacking the king's own standard, and they promise to pay great fines to the Lancaster heirs to compensate them for the deaths of their fathers. But they pay in tally sticks that were given to them from the king's exchequer, worthless promises of royal wealth that the king will never honour, but that Lancaster can never refuse, because to do so would be to admit that the kingdom is penniless. It is a brilliant joke, and a powerful insult to the king. They promise to build a chantry at St. Albans for masses, for the souls of the fallen. And they all vow to keep a future peace. Only the king thinks that a blood feud that is set to go down the generations can be thus halted with sweet words, a bouquet of sticks, and a promise. The rest of us see lies laid upon deaths, dishonour on murder. Then the king returns to London from his retreat and declares a love day, a day when we shall all walk together, hand in hand, and all will be forgiven. "The lion shall lie down with the lamb," he says to me. "Do you see?" I do see. I see a city riven with faction and ready to make war. I see Edmund Beaufort's son, who lost his father at St. Albans, is ordered to walk hand in hand with the Earl of Salisbury, and they stand at arm's length, fingers touching, as if they could feel wet blood on their fingertips. Behind them comes his father's killer, the Earl of Warwick, and he walks hand fast with the Duke of Exeter, who has sworn secretly that there shall be no forgiveness. Next comes the king, looking well, glowing with happiness at this procession that he thinks shows to the people that the peers are united under his rule once more. And behind him comes the Queen. She should have walked alone. As soon as I saw her, I knew that she should have walked alone, like a queen. Instead, the King has placed her hand in hand with the Duke of York. He thinks it shows their friendship. It does not. It says to the whole world that they were enemies once, and that they could be enemies again. It says nothing of goodwill and forgiveness, but it exposes Margaret as a player in this deadly game. Not a queen above faction, but a queen militant, and York as her enemy. Of all the follies on this day when we all went hand in hand, Richard and I among the others, this is the worst of them. Westminster Palace, London, winter 1458. The Love Day peace lasts only for 8 months. I leave court in the summer for my confinement and give birth to another baby, a daughter whom we call Catherine, and when she's well and strong and thriving at the breast of the wet nurse, we leave home and stay with my daughter Elizabeth at Groby Hall. She is brought to bed with a child, and she has another boy. "What a blessing you are to the Greys," I say to her, as I'm leaning over the cradle. "Another baby? And a boy?" "You would think they would thank me for it," she says. "John is as dear to me as ever, but his mother does nothing but complain." I shrug. "Perhaps it's time for the two of you to move to one of the other grey houses," I suggest. "Perhaps there is not room for two mistresses in Groby Hall." "Perhaps I should come to court," Elizabeth says. "I could serve Queen Margaret and stay with you." I shake my head. "It is no pleasant place at the moment," I say. "Not even for the lady-in-waiting whom you would be. Your father and I have to go back, and I dread what I will find." I return to a court busy with rumour. The Queen requires that the Earl of Warwick take the almost impossible task of keeping the narrow seas safe for English shipping, but at the same time hand over the fortress of Calais to Edmund Beaufort's son, the new young Duke of Somerset, an inveterate enemy of all the York lords. This is to ask a man to do difficult and dangerous work, and to give the reward to his rival. Warwick, of course, refuses. And just as Richard predicted, the Queen hopes to entrap him with an accusation of treason. In November, she publicly blames him for piracy, using his ships out of Calais, and a parliament packed with her supporters commands him to come to London and stand trial. Proudly, he arrives to defend himself and confronts them all, a courageous young man alone before his enemies. Richard comes out of the royal council room to find me waiting outside and tells me that Warwick shouted down the accusations and claimed in turn that the Loveday agreement had been betrayed by the Queen herself. "He's raging," he says, "and it's so heated it could come to blows." Just at that moment, there is a crash against the council chamber door, and at once Richard jumps forward, drawing his sword, his other arm outstretched to shield me. "Jacquetta, go to the Queen," he shouts. I am about to turn and run, when my way is barred by men in the livery of the Duke of Buckingham, storming down the hall with their swords drawn. "Behind you," I say quickly to Richard, and step back against the wall as the men come towards us. Richard is on guard, sword drawn to defend us. But the men run past us without a glance, and I see from the other direction Somerset's guards are ready, blocking the hall. It is an ambush. The council doors are flung open, and Warwick and his men in tight formation come out fighting. They've been attacked in the very council chamber, and outside the men are waiting to finish them off. Richard steps abruptly back and crushes me against the wall.
"Stay quiet," he commands me.
Warwick, sword like a flail, goes straight at his enemies, stabbing and striking, his men tight behind him. One loses his sword, and I see him punch out in rage. One falls, and they step over him to hold the defensive box around their commander. Clearly, they would die for him. The hall is too narrow for a fight. The soldiers jostle one another, and then Warwick puts down his bare head, shouts, "Our Warwick!" his battle cry, and makes a run for it. Moving as one, his men charge at their attackers. They break out and are free. The men of Somerset and Buckingham running after them like hounds after deer, and they are gone. We hear a bellow of rage as the royal guard catches the Buckingham men and holds them, and then the noise of running feet as Warwick gets away. Richard steps back and pulls me to his side, sheathing his sword. "Did I hurt you, love? I'm sorry." "No, no." I'm breathless with shock. "What was that? What is happening?"
"That, I think, was the Queen sending the two dukes to finish what their fathers started. The end of the truce. And that, I think, was Warwick drawing his sword in the domain of a royal palace and getting away to Calais. Betrayal and treason. We'd better go to the Queen and see what she knows about this."
By the time we get to her rooms, the privy chamber door is closed, and the women are outside in her presence chamber, gossiping furiously. They rush towards us as we come in, but I brush them aside and tap on the door, and she calls me and Richard in together. The young Duke of Somerset is there already, whispering to her. She glances at my shocked face and hurries to me.
"Jacquetta, were you there? Not hurt?"
"Your Grace, the Earl of Warwick was attacked in the council chamber itself," I say bluntly. "By men in the livery of Buckingham and Somerset."
"But not by me," the 22-year-old Duke says, as pert as a child.
"Your men," my husband observes, his tone level. "And it is illegal to draw a sword in the royal court." He turns to the Queen. "Your Grace, everyone will think this is ordered by you, and it is most treacherous. It was in the council chamber, in the domain of the court. You are supposed to be reconciled. You gave your royal word. It is dishonourable. Warwick will complain, and he will be right to do so." She flushes at that and glances to the Duke, who shrugs his shoulders.
"Warwick doesn't deserve an honourable death," he says pettishly. "He didn't give my father an honourable death."
"Your father died in battle," Richard points out. "A fair fight. And Warwick has begged and been given your forgiveness, and paid for a chantry in your father's name. That grievance is over, and you have been paid for the loss of your father. This was an attack inside the safety of the court. How will the council do its business if a man risks his life attending? How will any of the York lords dare to come again? How can men of good will come to a council that attacks its own members? How can a man of honour serve such a rule?"
"He got away." The Queen ignores Richard to ask me, as if this is all that matters.
"He got away," I say.
"I should think he will get all the way to Calais, and you will have a powerful enemy in a fortified castle off your shores," Richard says bitterly. "And I can tell you that not one town in 100 can be defended against attack on the south coast. He could sail up the Thames and bombard the Tower, and now he will think himself free to do so. You have broken his alliance for nothing, and put us all in danger."
"He was our enemy at any time," young Somerset remarks.
"He was our enemy before this."
"He was bound by a truce," Richard insists, "and by his oath of allegiance to the king. He honoured it, Attacking him in the council chamber releases him from both.
"We shall leave London," the Queen rules.
"That's not the solution," Richard explodes. "You can't make an enemy like this and think that all you need to do is flee. Where will we be safe? Tutbury? Kenilworth? Coventry? Do you think to abandon the southern counties of England altogether? Shall Warwick just march in? Is it your plan to give him Sandwich, as you have given him Calais? Shall you give him London?"
"I shall take my son and go," she rounds on him. "And I shall raise troops, loyal men, and arm. When Warwick lands, he will find my army waiting for him. And this time we will beat him. And he will pay for his crime."
On campaign, summer, autumn 1459. The Queen is like a woman possessed by a vision. She takes the court with her to Coventry, the king in her train. He has no say in what happens now. He is startled by the failure of his truce and the sudden rush into war. She defies advice to be careful. She can smell victory, and she's eager for it. She enters Coventry with all the ceremony of a reigning king, and they bow to her as if she were the acknowledged ruler of the country. No one has seen a Queen of England like this before. She is served on one knee like a king. She sits under the royal canopy. She musters men. She demands a levy of every man from every county in England, ignoring the traditional way of raising an army, which is that each lord calls out his own men. From Cheshire she recruits her own army. She calls it the Prince's Army, and she distributes his own badge, the new livery of the Swan. She calls his captains the Knights of the Swan, and promises them a special place in the battle that is certain to come. The Swan children wore collars of gold, and were hidden by their mother to appear like swans, and they all came back but one, I say, uneasy at her sudden love of this badge, at her invoking this old myth. This is nothing to do with Prince Edward. The prince looks up at me, and beams one of his sudden radiant smiles.
"Swan," he repeats.
She has taught him the word. She has sewn two swan badges of silver on his collar. "You said you had seen the crown of England taken by a swan," she reminds me. I flush, thinking of the lie I told to hide the real vision, of my daughter Elizabeth laughing with a ring shaped like a crown on her finger. It came to me like a daydream, Your Grace, and I warned you that it might mean nothing. "I will take England, if I have to turn into a swan myself to do it." We move to Eccleshell Castle, 50 miles north of Coventry, in September, and we are less and less like a court, more like an army. Many of the ladies-in-waiting have gone back to their homes as their husbands have been summoned to march with the Queen Militant. Some of them stay away. The few ladies who travel with the Queen and me all have husbands in her rapidly growing army. We are like a baggage train on the march, not a court. The King is with us, and the Prince. Both of them go out daily to attend the musters of men, as Margaret brings in more and more recruits that she houses in the buildings inside the castle walls and in tents in the fields around. She calls on the loyal lords to come to her support. She parades the young prince before them. He is only 6 years old. He rides his little white pony around the ranks of the men, straight-backed and obedient to his mother's commands. His father comes to the castle gate and holds up his hand, as if blessing the thousands of men who are under his standard. "Is it the French?" he asks me wonderingly. "Are we going to take Bordeaux?" "There is no war yet," I reassure him. "Perhaps we can avoid war." Old James Touché, Lord Audley, is to command the army, and Lord Thomas Stanley is to support him. Lord Audley comes to the Queen with the news that the York Lords are assembling their forces in England and mustering their men. They are planning to meet at York's castle at Ludlow, and so the Earl of Salisbury will have to march south from his castle of Middleham, in the north of England, to Ludlow, on the borders of Wales. Lord Audley swears that we will catch him as he marches nearby, and take him by surprise as he hurries to join the other treasonous lords. Our forces will be about 10,000 men. Thousands more will come with Lord Stanley. Salisbury has a force of less than half that number. He's marching to his death, hopelessly undermanned, and he doesn't know it. I find it a grim process, watching the men arm, check their weapons and their equipment, and form up in ranks. Elizabeth's husband, Sir John Grey, on his beautiful horse, leads an armed band of his tenants on the 2-day march from his home. He tells me that Elizabeth cried unstoppably as he left, and seemed filled with foreboding. She asked him not to go, and his mother ordered her to her room like a naughty child. "Should I have stayed with her?" he asks me. "I thought it my duty to come." "You are right to do your duty." I repeat the worn phrase which allows wives to release their husbands and women to send their sons to war. "I'm sure you are right to do your duty, John." The Queen appoints him as head of cavalry. "Anthony, my most precious son, comes from our home at Grafton and will fight alongside his father. They will ride to the battle and then dismount and fight on foot. The thought of my son in battle makes me so sick that I cannot eat for fear." "I am lucky," Richard says stoutly to me. "You know I am lucky. You've seen me ride out to a dozen battles, and I always come safe home to you. I will keep him at my side. He will be lucky too." "Don't say it, don't say it." I put my hand over his mouth. "It's to tempt fate. Dear God, do you have to go out this time?" "This time, and every time, until the country is at peace," my husband says simply.
"But the King himself has not commanded it."
"Jacquetta, are you asking me to turn traitor? Do you want me to wear a white rose for York?"
"Of course not, of course not. It's just..."
Gently he takes me in his arms. "It's just what? Just that you cannot bear to see Anthony in danger?" Ashamed, I nod.
"My son," I whisper, anguished.
"He is a man now. Danger comes to him like snow in winter, like flowers in springtime. He is a brave young man. I have taught him courage. Don't you teach him to be a coward." My head comes up at that, and my husband chuckles. "So you don't want him to go to war, but you don't want him to be a coward? Where's the sense in it? Now you be brave, and come and see us march out. And wave your hand, and smile, and give us your blessing." We go to the door together, his hand warm on my waist. The Queen has ordered the army to troop before the drawbridge of the castle, and the little prince is there on his white pony. Anthony comes from the ranks and kneels swiftly before me, and I put my hand down on the warm, soft hair of his precious head. "God bless you, my son." I can hardly speak for the tightness in my throat. I can feel the tears hot in my eyes. He rises up and stands before me, excited and ready to go. "I want to add, and do what your father tells you, and keep your horse near you so that you can get away, and stay out of danger, and there's no need to get too close to the fighting." But Richard draws me close and kisses me quickly on the mouth to silence me. "God bless you, my husband," I say. "Come home safely to me, both of you." "I always do," Richard replies. "And I will bring Anthony safe home too." The Queen and I, her ladies-in-waiting, and the Prince and his household stand and wave as they march past us, the standards flapping in the breeze, and the men looking eager.